Hello, everyone. This is the Stark Truth on Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Robert Stark. My guest is Dan Kanukistan. Dan, it's nice having you on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
So you're with the New Resistance.
Yes, sir.
And how long have you been involved with activism?
Well, I'd say that I've always been involved in probably I would call it extreme politics or alternative politics since my late teens. I probably got involved in what you call the extreme right, probably starting in the late 80s. Got interested in the National Revolutionary Movement, probably towards the 90s.
And can you explain what the National Revolutionary Movement is?
Well, yeah, basically it was known as the Third Positionist Movement, you know, back in the 80s. Basically, it was sort of nationalism with some leftist ideas mixed in, generally anti-capitalist. Our influences basically came from Europe. We had especially the original New Resistance, for example, was a French group, the Nouvelle Resistance, which was led by Christian Boucher, and it sort of had an eclectic ideology, which was a very anti-capitalist, and it made common cause with various separatist groups and leftist groups around the world, including Libya, for example. They actually visited Libya several times. And that's where our interest started, you know, and the Italians as well. They had a very, very active national revolutionary movement as well. So that's where we basically got our influence from.
So New Resistance, is that that's the overall movement, or that's the specific organization?
Well, it's a loose network. We started it about practically almost a year ago right now. It emerged out of what was known as the American Front. We decided to take it to a different, the American Front was always sort of a third positionist group to begin with. But we wanted to take it to a more left-wing, take it basically out of the old nationalist movement and right into a new direction. We're basically trying to target people that, a different demographic than we normally have. Than you normally see in the nationalist movement. We're trying to go towards the younger set, the people who are precarious labor, as we call them, people who are sort of on the edge of the capitalist system, and I'm trying to basically the people who are on the edge, basically, is what we're going for.
So you see, do you see more success in recruiting from the left than you do from the right? I know people are kind of caught up in those labels, and when you talk about the left and the right, you have a very different idea than the average person. But from you see more opportunities in recruiting from the left.
Well, yeah, the left. We're not talking about the let's say the ideologically driven left. We're talking about people who are vaguely left. You know, people, for example, the Occupy Wall Street movement, for example. These people are not really hardcore Marxist or hardcore anarchist. These are people that are just vaguely, you know, they sort of lean that way. The same thing, you know, my earliest contacts with leftists, you know, going back 10 years or more, you know, basically are people I would call hippies or neo-hippies, you know, people that are, again, interested in the environment or anti-capitalist, but they're not really rigid in their beliefs. They're very mellow in terms of how, on who they will deal with. You know, they're not restrictive in terms of who they're willing to work with. So that's basically what we're driving towards.
I know, because it's a very interesting issue of getting beyond sort of the left-right dichotomy, and that's sort of what third position stands for. Mm-hmm. And I know groups sort of like the Southern Poverty Law Center they're always going around like warning like leftists to stay away from like these third positionist groups that try to recruit from them.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, even within the left itself, they're very dogmatic, and they basically do have this idea of like no platform for fascists. And they define fascists however they want to define fascists. Like I said, by going by not really obsessing so much with these sort of established leftist groups and going more towards what we call the vague left, or you know, the non-dogmatic left, we kind of avoid that altogether. We're dealing with a lot of people, for example, that are new agey, people, for example, who are involved in the Zeitgeist movement, for example. That's another thing that I've noticed with young people. That's been a big influence on them. We deal with people, for example, who are involved in the marijuana legalization movement. So there's a lot of things you can sort of bypass, you know, the old tired left-wing elements that are reactionary anyway, and go to the people that are really more organic in their outlook. So that's where we're headed anyway. We're trying to head that way.
I think in the past there were people on the left who like their focus is more on like working class issues, but their mm-hmm. focus more the left today they're focused on issues like political correctness, feminism, yes. Support for massive immigration, and even if you look at the environmental issues, I mean that's sort of they've thrown it all under the bus.
Yeah, exactly. That's another point. The left, including labor unions, they basically abandoned what was called the white working class. You have a whole generation or two of people right now that are precarious labor. They don't have a steady employment. They're living from paycheck to paycheck. They're involved in temporary jobs. And it's very difficult for them. And basically the unions, with few exceptions, have basically abandoned them. And the left generally has abandoned them. They rather deal with these kind of, cultural issues that really don't affect the average working person. So yeah, that's another aspect that, that we figure that's going to be an area we can cover as opposed to the old left. So yeah, that's true.
So the organization, it is it's sort of geared towards the white working class.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. It's not like we don't view race, for example, by white. We don't obsess with race as such. One of our influences, actually, we discovered recently was the Young Patriot Movement, which was a group, a leftist group that existed in the 1970s, I think late 60s, early 70s, something like that. And they were composed of poor, working class, Appalachian youth, basically, that migrated up into the northern cities like Chicago, and they were very progressive and they were very radical in viewpoint, and they even wore the Confederate flag on their jackets. But they were completely revolutionary. They worked with the Black Panther Party at the time, and that's sort of like where we're headed in that area. Like I said, it's more trying to get a hold of and link up with working class youth and poor underclass as well, and that's where we're going.
And you talk about the sort of class versus race dichotomy versus debate, mm-hmm. and you say that your organization sides with non-white or mixed race workers over white capitalists. Can you sort of give some examples of where there of conflicts between non-white workers and white capitalists where you would side with them? I know you talk about some of the things going on in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
Are there also cases in the United States or Canada you could point out to?
Oh, absolutely. Especially now, there's many examples now of, for example, domestic workers brought in from the third world to work. They work in these temporary agencies, for example, in Canada and the United States. They work for peanuts, or they're actually, in some cases, they're almost slave labor. There was a bit of a scandal recently where the Canadian government was hiring one of these temp agencies, and they were using these third world workers, basically. So people who want to complain, for example, about mass immigration, but at the same time, they want to ignore these kind of situations where white capitalists are, in fact, bringing these people in and mistreating them. That's where we want to stand against that. And we think one of the best ways, if you want to take care of immigration situation, is that you actually raise the wages of these workers. You can build walls, you can have a real restrictive immigration system, but the surest way is really where you enforce these laws against the capitalists, so that they actually pay a living wage to people, so that it would be at some point it would be uneconomic for them to actually hire these people. So that's how we view it. So that's one example there. That's right in our own backyard.
I know on your site you talk about the issue of mass immigration, and you quote Alain de Benoist, and I know a lot of his writings are on this site, Countercurrents. There's a lot of his writings on here, and he's affiliated with the movement called the New Right. But he said, this is the quote from Alain de Benoist that you point out on your, what's on your site is, those who remain silent about capitalism should not complain about immigration.
Oh, exactly. It's just basically, this is what drives people into the first world from the third world. It's not like the right has this mentality, I find, that the people in the third world have this hive mind, and they basically want to get at Whitey. They want to move here just to piss off Whitey. And that's not really what the thing is. It's basically what's happening is that capitalists, generally white capitalists in the West, are going into these countries. They're basically disrupting their economy, and they're forcing basically people to move into other areas, into our areas, into North America, into Europe. So if you take this exploitation of the third world, you take this out of the picture, we won't have this problem. So we have to start really looking at this seriously and stop acting like these people are basically have this revenge complex against us. It's not that at all. They basically want a fair. Nobody really wants to leave where they've lived all their lives to move someplace completely alien. So, like I said, we have to look at things differently, change our whole view of this.
You talk about recruiting leftists. I think leftists are also told by their leaders that anyone who opposes mass immigration is they're a racist or they're a right winger, and they're the leftist side. They're all caught up in that dichotomy as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, do it. This is really something, it's a blind spot for the left, really, because immigration, there's environmental impacts of immigration. Immigration also affects the workforce that is right there in your backyard. It drives down wages, it drives down worker safety, it drives down all these issues that used to be bread and butter for the left. And, if you look historically, the left and the unions used to be anti-immigration. And if you actually look at even, what's his name, Chavez, the Mexican union leader in the States, back in the 60s, he was against immigration. Not many people remember this. So I think it's important to remind the left of its historic you know, positions that it used to take before, that when it used to be actually pro working class, you know, rather than, you know, culturally for all these weird groups now. So.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Those, you're talking about, Cesar Chavez.
Yes.
And there was the whole kind of Chicano movement of the 60s. But right. That, I mean, the kind of the people today who claim that mantle, like groups, they're totally in bed with the big corporate interest, because they, and the other thing is, the elites, they use the race issue, they try to smear the working class whites as being racist for not mm-hmm. going along with what they want. And they kind of try to intimidate. I mean, you're talking about how the elites are sort of the ones that are exploiting people. But if you notice, like if you watch movies in Hollywood, there's sort of the stereotype of the working class kind of racist hick.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's so blatant. You know, it's the deliverance meme that they put out. You know, it's always going to be that way. Hollywood's always going to do this. You know, before it did it with blacks. You know, it used to stereotype blacks a certain way, and now it's acceptable to do the same thing for white workers or to poor whites or Appalachian whites or, you know, yeah, that's always the way it's going to be. Yeah. Yeah.
And you talk about a national personal autonomy.
Yes, yes. Yeah, well, basically, we're trying to figure out, you know, like, a system that's not going to involve, you know, like a Mad Max race war. You know? We're thinking, like, it's really unreasonable to expect large populations to be basically moved from one end to the other and reshifted. And so we were looking at what can be a way that we can set things up that people can have their cultural institutions. And you know, maybe like, remain separate in a cultural way, yet at some times work together in certain other areas, you know. If there's, for example, in defense or in medical services or whatever, you know, like, can we share certain things, you know, and other areas remain separate, you know, still have a separate community. So we came across this idea, actually. It's an older idea that came from the Austrian Marxist. And it was actually a very novel idea. It came out of the Austro-Hungarian Empire because they operated on that level too. You know, they had sort of different cultures that sort of lived together for a while in a fairly peaceable way. So we thought, you know, for a model for North America, this would actually be an interesting model as something to throw out there for people to look at. Yeah.
And you talk about some of the economic and social policies.
Yes. We're not dogmatic there either. You know, like we think that certain things could have market solutions, other things could have socialist solutions. It really depends. You know, I think that Marxists, hardcore Marxists and also hardcore libertarians, I think when they need to basically not be so dogmatic in that sense. You know, you got to look what works at a given place at a given time rather than you know, try to push a solution that doesn't fit the situation. So, yeah, we're open to a lot of things. We look at everything from we look at Marxists, we look at libertarians, we look at my friend James, he looks into the marketing groups, and we find some good ideas there. So, you know, we'll look anywhere for a solution that's practical. So basically, we're very practical in that sense. You know, we're not dogmatic.
And you talk about, I'll go over some of these things issues are,
sure.
The distribution of land is one of them.
The distribution of what?
Of land.
Land, yes. Yeah, we think that it's important that that the people have access to their own land, and that it's not transferable, you know, that it's somewhere down the road, somebody can come along and buy up lots of land, you end up with absentee landlordism and that problem like we have now. So basically, everybody should be assured free land and free housing and a way to live without, you know, so that they're independent. So yeah, that's very important. That's what Gaddafi basically did in Libya before he was ousted. He basically said that everybody is entitled to housing and to an apartment or to a house or whatever. Yeah, that's basically, we go along that line as well.
And that's the debate about property rights. Mm-hmm. A lot of libertarians and conservatives believe in an absolute property rights. And I think when it comes to there's the issue of a homeowner who has a right to protect their home against eminent domain. And there's the sort of individual property rights. But then some of these types take it further. There's the issue of you get into corporate property rights and issues like corporate agriculture or sort of someone wants to just buy up a bunch of wilderness and put up a bunch of tract homes. And I think that's totally – that has to be totally separated from the individual property rights.
Oh, absolutely. For the individual, like you say, for families or small businesses, nobody wants to mess with them, really. It's these accumulation of property is the problem. And also the people who use property in a way that to the detriment of another person, you know, like for example, you talk about agriculture, you know, like you can't really have absolute property rights if you're in agriculture. You can't just, let's say you plant a line of trees along the border of your property, and if it puts shadow on your neighbor's crops, that's considered a no-no. Even today, it's considered a no-no. Basically, you're supposed to have certain respect for your neighbor. So, you know, absolute property rights, yes, but you also have to look in terms of your community. You can't let your cows crap in the river, for example, that goes down to your neighbor's property. So, you know, there's within reason, you know, but for the most part, you know, you're not going to mess with anybody in their own property for sure.
And there's definitely a focus on small businesses and small farms.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're not against we're not for collectivization of agriculture, collectivization of stuff like that. But I think that sort of socialism doesn't appeal to us. I don't think it'll appeal to anyone in North America really. What we talk about is sort of like a public ownership maybe of the power supply, you know, or ownership of a transportation network, for example. These kind of things make sense, you know, that on a certain scale, it makes sense to have the ownership of those things publicly. But, the emphasis for sure is going to be for people to have to have their own property, to own a small business. We like the idea of a cottage industry, returning that. And I think there's certain technologies right now that are going to help that. We've seen, for example, the rise of 3D printing, for example. That just might revolutionize how we look at manufacturing. Maybe we're going to return to the old cottage industries that we've seen in England, you know, prior to the Industrial Revolution. You could see some sort of revitalization of that. So, so I think that the world really, I think we can have a real new sort of revolution in terms of the economy if we remain positive, you know.
And talk about curtailing rampant consumerism and car culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you look at it, the car culture has been subsidized by the government. I mean, the interstate highway system. If you want to be a libertarian, you know, you got to look at it that way too. I mean, the government has decided, the government and industry together has decided, you know, what modes of transportation make sense for us. It also has a nuclear industry. Nuclear power, I don't think would have existed unless you had this corporate government, collusion to create this industry, because it doesn't make sense economically. Just to shut down these reactors after the end of their life, it just takes so much money. It's not even worth it. So we have to rethink all these things, rethink industry, rethink transportation, look at things in a sustainable way, and look at the green technologies that we can use. Rethink everything, basically.
And there's a post to Outsiders, the Loyal Opposition, and this deals with groups sort of like libertarians. So mm-hmm. Is this sort of about groups about which are potential allies, but not necessarily on the same page, but allies on some issues? Is that what you're sort of getting at?
Well, no, that too, but I think we kind of look at every society. It doesn't matter, like in a post-revolutionary society, it's going to be the same thing. You're going to have a mainstream, and then you're going to have sort of the innovative outsiders, the bohemians, people that are innovative artists and for free thinkers and for people who are people that are like avant-garde artists and things like this. You got to have a lot of tolerance for people like that. Give them their space. And, don't come down on them and try to make them conform. So I think society has to always have to take them into account, because they bring a lot of creative energy and a lot of new ideas into the mainstream. So that's basically where we're at. We don't want to force people to conform. A lot of people might view our version of socialism, for example, as it's going to coerce people into living a certain way, but it's quite the opposite. We want to liberate people. We want people to have the economic freedom where they can pursue their dreams the way that they like. So that's where we're coming from.
Are there some similarities to national anarchism?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've known national anarchists since the beginning of modern beginning of national anarchism. I've known Troy Southgate for many, many years, one of my earliest political contacts, in fact. We endorse that way of thinking. We think that within our vision in North America, I think there's plenty of room for national anarchist communities to exist. Like I said, we maybe disagree with them on certain elements, for example, the larger enterprises being owned by the public. They probably think that there will be a general collapse and everything will go down to the village level. We think that, that there's still room, even if there is a collapse of capitalism, that there's room for, larger institutions, in their place. I think that's where we differ, but absolutely, we completely think that they have the right to exist as they want to live. So, yeah.
And I think there's sort of these national anarchist ideas. I think different ideas can work in different places. Like, I think national anarchism would work more in rural areas, but it might not work completely in a more urban area.
Well, yeah, that's why we talk about, national personal autonomy. Like, in a city that's been established for many years, that's cosmopolitan, you can't always make little villages there. Basically, like you say, it's in a homogeneous area of the countryside where people have, are basically of the same ethnic group. Yeah, that would work better there, I would think. So, we want maximum diversity. But there's diversity not only in terms of the different kind of communities you can have, but also the scale of the communities. You can have villages, you can have larger institutions, you can have, let's say, for example, if you have a bioregion and then you have various small city-states, and you want to band together, for example, for medicine, you could have an order of a medical order, you know, that would allow people to have a medical university and to have, you know, a better scale of services, you know, without impeding upon their independence. So that's, you know, that's where we come from.
And you also, you point to the sort of the Swiss Canton model as a possible idea.
Yeah. The Swiss Canton model is one idea. You know, basically people can separate when they want. I guess if they vote a certain way, they can separate from the political unit they're in at the moment. Semi-autonomy and autonomy. And, you know, like I said, it's not, we don't want to standardize everything. We think there could be a wide variety of political units that could exist, especially in North America. I mean, I think that's the natural way of North America. I think the idea you can have a centralized state like Canada and the United States, I think they're unnatural growths on this continent. And it's going to have to go like the original idea, I think, when the French Canadians settled, for example, in North America, they had these loose alliances with various Indian tribes and with, you know, there was the Spanish colonists and all this, and they sort of had a very loose network. The same thing, the 13 colonies was, you know, very loose. And then the original United States, it was again a very loose kind of setup. You know, Jefferson, you know, talked about the Republic of Republics, you know. So again, we're basically returning back to the original idea of America, I think, by going this route.
So you have an article, it's called Revolutionary Preservationists Going Beyond the Status, Anti-Status Paradigm.
Right.
And I think what you have to point out is the mainstream people, they follow the left-right paradigm, which is fraudulent. But at the same time, the libertarians come around and they say that the real paradigm is big government versus small government. And that at the same time, that's way too simplistic as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, to some extent, it's like you're arguing whether the chicken or the egg came first. You know, does the state run things or does the corporation run the state? Like I said, I go back to Rothbard. You know, he pointed out how all these corporate families, you know, going back over hundred years or so, are basically running the show. And you do see this right now with how, you know, with the various in Congress in the United States and in the Canadian Parliament, you do see corporate interests basically running things.
The thing is, a lot of libertarians actually, they do acknowledge that the big corporate interest behind the government, but at the same time, they say that by having libertarianism, it'll fix that problem. But that isn't, I mean, I'm not, and you, the government is, I mean, there's so, the government and the corporations are so in bed with each other, but just dramatically reducing the government wouldn't solve all the problems in regards to the big corporations. It's all about, I mean, I think any institution that becomes too big becomes corrupt.
I agree. And I think the problem with libertarians who argue that is that in many ways they're arguing in a similar vein to Marxists. You know, you always say, you know, socialism, you know, never had a chance, you know, never existed the way it should have existed, you know, like, but you got to deal with real existing socialism. You have to deal with real existing capitalism. You know, capitalism always operated this way. You know, you can't, you know, like they're always looking for this pure capitalism that never existed. So you got to look at the nature of capitalism. It's basically creative destruction. They're going to destroy the social links between people. That's the whole nature of capitalism. There's no way around that. So we have to start thinking away from capitalism. That doesn't mean we can't have a market solution in certain areas. It's just that we have to start thinking beyond this, you know, and start looking at it realistically, you know, because to try to say that the to say that the state is the only problem is wrong, because right now we're seeing the privatization of the military. We're seeing the shock doctrine, you know, to read Naomi Klein's book, which I recommend everybody read this book. You're going to see how this works. And it's basically they're going to hollow up the state, and the corporation is going to go in and it's going to take over everything. So
we have, and the corporation will just morph into its own government. So we'll still have a big government in the long run.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But they won't call themselves that. And that's the problem when people get, you know, too stuck into their ideology to realize this. You know, like Walmart, you know, works with FEMA, for example. The Department of Defense uses Blackwater and these other groups. So you have to deal with that reality. And you know, when you start seeing corporations privatizing water supply, as they're doing in certain third world countries, and you know, basically all these public institutions that the people paid for are basically being given to these corporations. You know, even now in Ontario, we have, you know, highways that have been turned over to these corporations, you know. So I think people are getting fed up with this, and there's an actual populist uprising against these things. So I think it would be, short-sighted of anarchists and libertarians to ignore this and to try to just.
And you say that all over the world there's movements going on against privatization of water supply and of energy grids.
Yes.
And has there been any opposition to that in the United States? And could also give some examples of some of those movements.
Well, yeah, there's been, I think it was in Wyoming or Montana, I forget, one of the two places, I think I used it in the article, where there was the privatization of the energy supply there, you know, and people were not too happy about that, but they pushed it through, and they ended up paying more for their energy. They didn't have to. We have cases in Canada of bus companies, you know, that are publicly funded for rural areas. There's no way the corporation is going to give the same level of service otherwise. And the governments are basically just giving this stuff away, giving away these franchises. And the same thing, too. In Canada, we have a public healthcare system. And there's this constant push from these for-profit HMOs, especially from the United States, to get into this, to get their toe into our market here. And Canadian healthcare is not perfect, but you know, it's definitely better than being thrown to the wolves when you're sick and you know, like in the United States, you know, if you get into a bad medical situation, you could be bankrupt for the rest of your life. And that doesn't really happen in Canada. So, there's a lot of opposition to this attempt to privatize a lot of our services that we built up and paid for.
And you talk about this, there's a libertarian movement in New Hampshire called the Free State Project, and you're obviously not a big fan of them. You compare them to the Israeli settlers in the West Bank.
Well, yeah, I sort of exaggerated there a bit.
That's kind of a stretch, but
yeah, it was a stretch. But the attitude, though, like when you listen to,
they want to kind of take over the state and sort of rather than respecting the local culture that's been in that area. Is that sort of what you're getting at?
Yeah, pretty much so. Yeah, they do that, and they're very arrogant in many ways. You know, they the way they go after some of the municipal employees, for example, you know, the town folks and the women that are the meter maids and the crossing guards, you know, the women that go and let the kids across across the street and that. They go after them, you know, for some libertarian principle, you know. to me, it seems childish in a way to do this, and it just alienates people. And we've seen similar things, like we have the Freeman movement that's come up to Canada, and they basically they get people into all sorts of trouble with the tax man, for example. It's, I don't mind people going against the tax man, but don't sell them a bill of goods about it. You know, you can get into a lot of people get a lot of trouble for that without realizing it. What I don't like is the idea that they equate everybody who works for the government on any level with secret policemen or the most repressive jackbooted thug. You know, that's how they equate a meter maid with a jackbooted thug, and I don't quite buy that.
And you sort of contrast, you talk about some of the ideas about government from the Nation of Islam, and you contrast with those of the sort of the neocons and the, some of the people involved with the Tea Party.
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, you see, the thing is, the Nation of Islam, like the example I pointed out in that article, the radical preservationist article, was that the Nation of Islam is very hostile to the U.S. government, very critical of the U.S. government. But at the same time, they actually have contracts with HUD, you know, for security in various projects. Their attitude is basically, you know, that that while you can oppose the government and its overall goals, you, at the same time, you can actually take over the government at the lower levels as a counterpower, and that's what they've been doing on the local level in the housing sections and all this. They've been taking that over, and I think that's a good strategy. You know, basically, you can't. It would be heartless, I think, to allow people to starve, allow people to kick people out into the streets because you have a pure libertarian philosophy. So that's how we kind of view it. We think that the state can be selectively brought down. You know, you can go after those elements of the government that are truly repressive, and you can keep as an interim institution those elements of the government that actually do public good. So that's how we view it. Again, it's not pure anti-statism, but that's how we look at it.
Before I wrap the show up, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I thank you for giving me this opportunity. This is the first time I've done an interview of any kind over the radio, and hopefully it turns out well. And again, thank you. I enjoy your show. I've listened to your archives, and you have a lot of interesting guests and very thought-provoking. And that's about it.
And the website, the main website is openrevolt.info, but you also have there's a couple other sites affiliated with your movement.
Yeah, there's there's AmericanFront.info, which is the Green Star website. AmericanFront.info, that's it. So those are the two main ones. It's Open Revolt and Green Star.
Yes. I'd like to thank Dan Kanukistan for being on. That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.